Hi, this is the Leading Language and Literature Podcast with me, Chris Jordan. In this episode, I'm speaking with Josie Sachs and Bridie McPherson. Bridie is Head of Department at Oasis Southbank Academy, and Josie is National Curriculum Lead for Oasis Community Learning. This interview came off the back of me watching Josie and Bridie talk as part of a We Are in Beta presentation via Comcast. The ideas and insights offered in those presentations around the likes of whole class feedback and standards within English teaching more broadly were fantastically concise and a brilliant indication of the work being done in the UK around curriculum and feedback more generally. In this episode, we discuss the best text Josie and Bridie have ever read, taught or been taught, the Key Stage 3 curriculum at Oasis Southbank, and the specific ideas that Bridie and Josie have chosen to construct the learning around, the kind of conversations or debates that led to textual choices in the scheme of learning, an example of one unit and the type of specific vocabulary and sentence structures that are introduced that then leads to whole class feedback in subsequent tasks. Later we talk about specifically what are the things that teachers cover in whole class feedback and how misconceptions are reviewed or that the correct approach has been internalized in the long term. And lastly, we discuss why models, exemplars, or live writing are not entirely effective in guiding students' understanding of a given task. Thanks a lot to Bridie and Josie for giving up time on the last Friday of term to chat about these things with such a massive amount of passion and investment. If you want to be kept up to date on when educational chat like this happens, then be sure to subscribe to the podcast and or follow me on Twitter at Chris Jordan. HK. Okay, Josie and Bridie, what is the best book you've ever read, taught, or been taught, respectively?
It's a big question, and a good question. We have a curriculum that's full of the texts that we loved reading, so we're very lucky because we could select our favorite texts. So I'm actually going to answer about the text that I've loved teaching the most. I've actually always taught Othello every year that I've been teaching. And so I'm really just in my element in the classroom, and we teach it to year nine. And I absolutely love that. But I'm also really excited to teach Things Fall Apart this year for the second time, but with a new unit of work. And I think that could be vying for a place in my top list. And mine is, in terms of my favourite thing that I've taught, Rime of the Ancient Mariner, which had a few raised eyebrows when we raised the idea that we would be teaching it in year eight. But it actually is such an amazing story and really pulls together a lot of the big themes and big ideas we have about heroism, about punishment, about conflict, and about how we make choices in life. So I really loved teaching that last year, and I'm really excited to teach it this year. And then the new thing that I'm looking forward to teaching is that we have some Zora Neale Hurston stories as part of our Harlem Renaissance unit that I added this year. They're two short stories and they are amazing. I would really recommend anyone who's looking at Key Stage 3 curriculum to look at them. They're called Spunk, unfortunately, and the other one is called Sweat. They're really, really amazing short stories. We teach them in year nine, and they really link to themes of, again, like heroism, but more in year nine we look at like ideas of femininity and masculinity and kind of reckoning with the self and like understanding who we are. And they're really amazing stories that are kind of set in this community and that talk about femininity and masculinity and the self. So I'd really recommend them.
There's lovely answers. I'm kind of I know that most of the texts that you talked about there, courtesy of a photo I saw on Twitter, I think on Bridie's feed, of like the curriculum that you've got in Key Stage 3. If you don't mind, I'll like jump ahead to one of the questions I was going to ask later, which was the curriculum that you've got at school seems to be ordered around concepts that span like one or two terms. So I think in year seven, you've got a heroism one that lasts like maybe even the whole year. I can't remember. What made you choose those specific ideas to construct the curriculum around?
So we started by thinking about mastery in writing and reading in A-level, but actually beyond that in kind of English degrees, and thinking about the things that are the core ideas to literature. So just like when you start an English degree, you would do a whole series of things on like medieval romantic poetry, and you would do epic poetry, and you would do Shakespearean tragedy. And the reason that those things form the foundation of almost all English degrees is because they form the foundation of a lot of literature, because they are articulating something or trying to articulate something quite kind of innate in the human condition. And that's what we tell kids that literature tries to do. Of course, we have to be we would love to do every single big idea, as we call them. So there's a bit of a negotiation that you have to do when you move from thinking about the discipline as a whole back to thinking about what we want 11-year-olds to do. So we then took it to GCSE and thought, okay, well, they're doing Macbeth and they're doing Inspector Calls, and we thought about all the texts there, and we thought about the core concepts that were not only core to those Key Stage 4 texts, but also core to other literature around the world, and that we're unlocking these things that were, yeah, as we say, like innate to the human condition. And we think that heroism and like the understanding of journeys and adventures and the battle between good and evil is kind of in really everything. Like, that's so foundational because it is so much an articulation of experience, like universal experience. And we also think it's really fun. So like we were thinking about engagement, a much debated word, but we were thinking about engagement and we were thinking about content. So yeah, all of year seven do heroism, and they think about, I guess, just like goodies and baddies, like the monstrous and the heroic, and what it means to be a hero. And first they start learning about how heroes go on adventures against monsters. And then when we get to Beowulf, we start to unpick the concept of a monster, and we learn that actually in a lot of texts, that monster might be an ostracized character who's also suffering. And so we basically add nuance with each unit. So we're not just saying, and as we know, this is about heroism. We're taking like a concept, and we're adding color to it and adding like shades of meaning over the course of each text. And we don't just then leave it at the end of year seven, because when they do, things fall apart in year eight, or as you can see on the curriculum map, all of those concepts are interleaved as well. And we're expecting them to be able to have a really well-rounded discussion about heroism and tragedy by the end of year eight. And of course that does lead to great success when they write about Macbeth in year 11 as well. So we're hoping that it's like an academic outcome thing, and also something that allows them to engage with the world around them in a really well-rounded way as well.
The other thing to note is, like, you know, there's a reason why we choose heroism at the beginning, because it's talking about character as character. So in year seven, we're not expecting them to talk about characters as constructs. We're expecting them to live in the world of a text. And as the years of Key Stage 3 go by, we start to teach them explicitly how to discuss and how to see characters as constructed by writers. So in year eight, they begin to look at, like, why did Shakespeare choose to make these decisions? They look at William Blake writing poetry to tell us something about the world. And that's like quite an important shift. It's not just thematic. It's also about like the way that we talk about and interact with text, so that by the time they get to Anita and Me, they can talk about, at the end of year nine, they can talk about the nuance of Mira Sayal and her desire to express and expose elements of society through the construction of a character. And so that's what sits alongside these bigger themes, is also a desire to move from the like internal world of the text to seeing the text as a construct. And we think we have to be really deliberate about that. Like, year sevens can't be doing loads of symbolic language analysis. They should be doing comprehension and inference. And that builds over time as well. So the two things kind of sit together.
And that's something we've had to not only be deliberate about, but also quite instructive and like directive about with our team, because I think like it's very easy when we, like, you have to hold back some of your own joy about literature, which often is analytical when you're talking to 11-year-olds, and like it's not always the right thing to say, here the verb blah exposes the connection between the writer and their context, and actually that's really alienating and so meta. So we don't really do the meta in, as Josie says, like, we're really passionate about the whole of it being like loving reading and understanding character and antithesis and opposition and journeys. And that's, yeah, so it's like doing one thing at a time. basically.
That's fascinating. Yeah, that kind of conversation around what do they have to do at university and backward planning from there, that's so hard. It's such a challenging thing to be able to kind of, because most of the kids that we're teaching aren't like precocious young readers like a lot of English teachers possibly were when they were kind of 11, 12 years old. So yeah, I can imagine that's really hard to cater for. Again, coming back to that curriculum map that
also,
you've got
I think
in,
we
go ahead, sorry.
Sorry, no, I was just going to say that what you said about whether they do it for A-level. I mean, the other thing to note is like, we're not just preparing them for A-level, we're preparing them for life. So like we think actually, even if they don't do A-level, even if they don't go on to do an English degree, like how great is it to equip them with the language to express what they already understand mm-hmm. about who the heroes are in their world, in mm-hmm. politics, in the media, in society, and to be able to like read nuance into that using really powerful vocab. So like, yes, you're completely right. Everyone should do English degrees. But also we think it kind of has power beyond that as well.
Yeah, and we want them to be able to like look at the world around them and their own lives. And as Josie said, they already, like, we're not telling them how to think or how to feel. They already had human experience as humans, which I think is important to remember when you're creating a curriculum. But we are equipping them with the words, like to say,
yeah,
hold on a sec, like you're speaking about this person like they're a monster, that they're ostracized, and like that's an example of how vocabulary is not just about exams for us, it's about life.
Yeah, no, I echo that completely. I think being able to articulate why you feel a particular way about someone in the media or in politics, like you say, or even just, you know, cinema and kind of TV and yeah. stuff like that, I think that's like a really valuable kind of ability to articulate and kind of like a set of values that is innate to us. Yeah, that, yeah, it's really admirable. The text that you're kind of exploring in Key Stage 3 is, I mean, to be honest, like it reads like it could be a GCSE course or even an A-level course, or like some of the texts that are on there, like Josie said before, like Rime of the Ancient Mariner, like I did at university. So the texts that you've chosen are obviously like generally of a very high standard in terms of rigor and significance. What kind of conversations or debates led to those choices? And are there any that you are like just introducing? I remember you said Rime of the Ancient Mariner is coming in soon or this year. And are there any that you're yes. thinking about changing? What kind of conversations are you having around that?
Yeah, so my role as my job is to be half my life an English teacher and half my life I run the curriculum for Oasis. So I was in a really fortunate position where I could kind of start from scratch and to think about what would be the dream, like Key Stage 3 curriculum. Obviously, we're curtailed a little bit for GCSE, but what's the dream Key Stage 3 curriculum? And the way that we began is, as Bridie said, like thinking about what are the stories that texts often tell and which texts best typify those types of stories. So when we look at Year 7, and as she said, like we want to look at journeys, we want to look at discovery, we want to look at heroes. That's why we start with that place and then we choose the text based on that. So that's why we have Greek Myths and then Antigone and Beowulf and A Wrinkle in Time. We want to have like really powerful stories that students can read, understand, and also to help them to see the world. And that was in conversation with lots of different leaders across the trust and with curriculum experts in my team as well. And as we move into Year 8, we thought that we want to have a really kind of clear understanding of what tragedy means and the nuance that exists within tragedy. So it isn't just about the tragedy of Romeo and Juliet. It's also about Blake's idea of the tragedy of the Industrial Revolution. It's about the tragedy of the Ancient Mariner. And it's about the tragedy and things fall apart. And whilst these are really complex texts, as teachers, we shouldn't choose texts that's, well, I believe as teachers, we should choose texts that we can best support students to understand. Mm. And so for me, I want to pitch the text just above the student's like level of independent understanding so that teachers can add and support them to reach the comprehension of a text they might not have been able to do independently. There's a space that exists for independent reading, but English is a space where we can actually really, if we work hard, if we instruct clearly, and if we demystify and codify what excellent reading and writing looks like, then we can these texts aren't that difficult, like in terms of the vocabulary they use, in terms of the ideas they present, they're not that hard. Of course, any text you can read at a degree level or beyond. And I think that's why sometimes people might look at the curriculum and think, oh, but I did that at university. We're not teaching them at a university level. So like in the same way that Shakespeare is also done at university.
Yeah, and everybody does Romeo and Juliet in Key Stage 3 and everybody does Romeo and Juliet in an English degree. So I think like it's interesting that I think the hard thing is that to the teacher who says, and I know you were voicing this, but loads of people say this. So to the teacher who says, things fall apart in year 8, are you mad? I would say, but that through co-planning and through really carefully constructed schemes of work, which Josie makes, we can make decisions about the way through the text, and the way through the text doesn't have to be the whole text. And actually it never should in Key Stage 3. Like if I was teaching, I don't know, Boy in Striped Pyjamas in year 7 or like Noughts and Crosses or whatever.
You still have to do cutting.
But maybe you could encompass every single theme and idea in the text because the text is written for that audience. Of course, I cannot teach when I'm teaching William Blake. And like, I have to be very conscious about doing this. I loved doing Blake at uni. And sometimes I'm teaching and I'm like, hey, it's actually quite interesting it's about as much of, people talk about what you should say when you're teaching, but I think it's as much about what you don't say. And that's not a kind of, we shouldn't have teacher talk kind of thing. It's more that you have to decide your limited way through the text, and the way through the text has to be, we are doing this unit to unlock this concept, and these are the 15 words therefore that we're going to teach, and this is what we want kids to be able to say about William Blake at the end. And it only goes wrong if we're if like doing justice to the text means doing everything. And that would always be wrong, I guess.
Yeah.
Because that's what they do in history. They're not going to really explain the nuance of like, I don't know,
every day of the
Third Reich in like year 9, they're not really gonna, like, we always have to limit. But I think sometimes as English teachers we get a bit like, but the honor of the text requires me to encompass everything that it possibly is.
And ultimately the text should serve the purpose of the unit as well. So like, we want our students to be expert readers and expert writers too. And as expert readers, we put on a set of lenses through which we see text all the time. So if I'm reading a book and I love sci-fi, the book might be a tragedy, but I see it through this certain lens. And like, that's kind of more generic version of what we're asking them to do in our curriculum, which is to say, like, we know all about alienation and tragedy. So how are we going to see these Zora Neale Hurston stories through that lens? How are we going to equip students to be able to articulate themselves in this particular way? And I think the difference with our curriculum versus perhaps others is that we are intentional about that. We don't leave it up to chance. And it's because we believe that if we do leave that kind of stuff up to chance, then ultimately the things that influence students' ability to comprehend text are external factors like cultural capital or socioeconomic background or, you know, a million other things that shouldn't actually influence their ability to comprehend a text. So because we're really intentional and because we codify the routes through, because we provide scripts and vocab, that hopefully means that there is a more even playing field and that the texts are accessible to all students in a way that maybe if we left it more up to chance, they wouldn't be.
Yes.
I don't know if I liked that
No, that I think, like, this is the most fascinating or interesting conversation that I think like English teaching professionals are having at the moment about like what texts should and shouldn't be covered and things like that. And I think just to take it back to what you said a moment ago about a lot of schools do Shakespeare in every single year of Key Stage 3, or at least one Shakespeare text in Key Stage 3, and surely, I mean, that offers up as much challenge as any other. I mean, okay, you can debate that, but on a kind of like on a language based level, contextual level, depth of thematic level, there's definitely, I look at like your Key Stage 3 plan and it's just, I think it's fantastic. I think every single one of those texts, I mean, with the likes of Beowulf and the Odyssey and things like that, you can kind of maybe have a discussion around what adaptation to use and should we be using the kind of, I can't remember the most recent Beowulf adaptation. Is it like Maria Devana?
There's a new one out this year.
Maria Devana Headley or someone like that. The one, she's a writer who's like worked with Neil Gaiman and stuff. So it's like, do you use that one? Do you use the Michael Moore Pergo? You know, okay, you can have those debates, but yeah, I completely echo what you said about the fact that I think it was Josie who said that I think independent reading, the likes of Noughts and Crosses, The Hunger Games, you know, these types of books, we should be trying to kind of foster that as much as possible. But yeah, we can with an English professional in the classroom, with an English teacher professional in the classroom, we can like kind of confidently structure conversation about like things fall apart. I was teaching today, funnily enough, as like part of my first year kind of GCSE. And I had a conversation with the teacher afterwards and said, we could teach this in year 9, we could teach this in year 8. I really don't think it's something which, it's a challenge, but it's not beyond the realms of kind of student comprehension. So, yeah, I think it's really...
And also, if you think about the kind of... Oh, sorry. If you think about the, like, the content of Romeo and Juliet and the... Like, I think people forget when they talk about difficulty of text or text they studied at university, like, also it's related to content, like, when we're asking students in year 8 to read Romeo and Juliet, we have to do a lot of like careful navigation around the like graphic content that's also there. And we should apply that same kind of care to something like Things Fall Apart. Of course, there needs to be care taken in like dealing with difficult themes of violence, themes of death. Like, but that's the same care that we take with Shakespeare. So I think we should be brave and take that same care with other texts as well.
Yeah, definitely. Sorry, Chris, I got one more thing to add on this topic.
Yeah.
I think there is an extra, there's an added point though, which is, so you'll notice that we have A Wrinkle in Time. I don't know if it's on my Twitter, the updated one, but A Wrinkle in Time is the summer
term. Yeah, it is. I think so, yeah.
A novel in our summer terms of all of our units. And we thought really carefully about this, and we're doing it for the first time this year, so we're going to like reflect afterwards and see how it's gone. But we actually did, in this case, want to choose a young adult novel that was, so while we looked at loads of the options that we know lots of other schools have, and we thought this one worked really well in terms of heroic journeys and like culminate, like brings together a lot of the threads of the other parts of year 7. I don't actually think it's wrong to, in a unit or two of Key Stage 3, have a text that actually they could access through independent reading. So these students could read, like, it's got some hard vocab, but like they could read A Wrinkle in Time at home. But it's very carefully placed for us, and it really couldn't be anywhere else in the sequence of year 7, because if we had A Wrinkle in Time at the beginning of year 7, then it would just be a cool story. But once we get to the end of year 7, we have lowered the difficulty of prose, but actually the expectations of ideas and like discussions around character and journeys will be like quite high. And so like we've chosen to have that sort of specific challenge in that particular place in the curriculum, and I think that is like that is also worthwhile doing. So it's not to say that every single Key Stage 3 curriculum has to have like hard text, and also I think the curriculum leaders also have to be careful that hard text doesn't just mean like white 17th century or 15th century. No one writes, what's anyone got from the 15th century? I don't know, but like I don't know, like that's not what we mean by challenging. We also do want to have like stories that talk about the same ideas from lots of different perspectives and lots of different voices. So I think that's just an important kind of additional point on
that. Yeah. We're not banning the YA novel.
Yeah, I know, and I love that book. I love A Wrinkle in Time. It's like, again, it's so weird. We're kind of having a discussion around whether to include that for like a year. I can't remember if it's a year 7 or year 8 unit next year. So I was in the process of rereading it last week, and it's just, yeah, such a brilliant book. I kind of came into contact with you, your guys' work in terms of via the Comcast kind of presentations that you did a couple of weeks ago, which were fantastic, by the way. And it was quite a lucky thing for me, in the sense that I'd been looking out for a long time in terms of something to do with whole class feedback in English. I read the Michael Childs book, The Feedback Pendulum or something like that, and I'd read a couple of blogs and spoke to a couple of people about it. And yeah, just unbelievably out of nowhere, I think I sent a message to Josh Valance, and he kind of pushed me in the direction of Bridie, and I watched the Comcast thing, and it was just fantastic, guys. It was so good, so informative. Yeah. It was worth staying up until, I think it was 2:30 in the morning. I
didn't stay. Yeah. Party,
yeah.
Yeah, the best kind. I just thought, like, I'm coming back to something that you've discussed on there, But in terms of what you said on that, correct me if I'm wrong, but before whole class feedback can actually happen, you obviously plan within the curriculum for specific vocabulary and sentence structures and content knowledge that you've explicitly taught, and you've kind of spoken about that already in your previous answers. Can you give me an example of like one unit and the type of specific vocab and sentence structures that are introduced that you can then give feedback on during whole class feedback?
Yeah, so I thought it'd be useful to talk about something I'm making now, which is the final year, the final term of year 9. As Bridie said, we do a novel at the end of each one, and I'm doing, at the moment I'm writing lessons for Anita and Me, which is a novel by Marisa Ayart. It's very good. And so it's interesting to think about this question in light of what I'm able to ask students to do in writing tasks at the end of year 9, because that is like the moment where they've basically completed the whole writing curriculum. If you go onto We Are in Beta, you can see, I think they've shared our writing curriculum there.
Yeah.
But just as an example, so I'm writing the Anita and Me lessons. And so what I know that students know how to do is they can use the words because, but, and so. They can use the phrase not only, but also. They can talk about symbolism from year 8 when we did that. But in year 9, we start to talk more about duality. So in Othello, we talk about duality. We have characters in opposition to each other. In the Zora Neale Hurston stories, we have duality, again, characters in opposition to each other. And in Anita and Me, we have duality because the character Mina is dual herself, like she has duality within herself. And that's like the ultimate degree of complexity for us in year 9. And so in order to talk about that duality within a character, we can use the phrase both and. So we can say she's both this and this. We can use the phrase she conflates one thing with another. We can put a participle at the beginning of a sentence. So we can say exploring the duality of childhood, comma, Sayal. We can, again, like draw from year 7 and 8 as well. So we can talk about symbolism. We can talk about because, but, so. We can talk about how she's neither something nor something else. And all of these phrases that I'm talking about are from what we've taught previously. So it's really nice to now get to year 9 and to be able to write lessons where I know I can expect students to use these different artful sentence constructions to create arguments and paragraphs and essays. And so that's kind of the, in terms of the sentence structure levels. So they're using participles, they're talking about opposition, they're talking about duality all through the use of these kind of like sentence constructions. And then in terms of what I'm looking at for vocabulary, I'm able to draw on the idea of who's potent and who's not based on year 7. I'm able to talk about from the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, he's enchanted and repulsed by nature. And Mina is enchanted and repulsed by Anita, the character that's kind of her friend or enemy. I'm able to talk about fascination, which we talk about in Othello. And I'm able to talk about the feeling of alienation because they've talked about being ostracized in year 7. So all of this vocab has had this really rich and exciting culmination in Anita and Me. And because we track that over time, it's then really easy to give feedback if year 9 writes something in their Anita and Me unit, because I know exactly what they've been taught in the past. And I can prompt them to include things I've explicitly taught. I think one of the things we spoke about in our session about feedback is you can't give feedback and tell students to do something you haven't told them how to do before. So we were talking about this and we thought about the idea of, wouldn't it be cool if kids could compare characters, so to say, much like Desdemona, Mina feels subservient to her father or something like that. And so you have to explicitly teach that phrase, much like. If we want them to be able to compare, we have to give them the tools to be able to compare. So we've got those kind of vocab, sorry, those sentence structures, and then we've got the vocab that sits within it. And I thought, yeah, Anita and Me is a good example because it all comes together. It's very exciting.
Yeah, it's a really good example, yeah. So if your department, if the teacher's happy that they've kind of done that, what after students have done some writing and you give them whole class feedback, what exactly does that look like in terms of, like, what would you cover on a whole class feedback sheet or slide or whatever the medium is?
So I guess it's essential. It falls into exactly the same categories as the curriculum design, because that guides the instruction. So everything we talk about falls into the categories of like artful sentences, so grammar and vocab and knowledge. So like the nuggets of knowledge that we talk about, like, I don't know, that a character, keep going back to the same example, but the character is monstrous because seen as monstrous because they're ostracized. So everything works in those like three strands because that's what we instruct. In terms of the like practicalities of what the sheet looks like, again, we've shared this just for ease if anyone wants it. We've shared this through VR and Meta after the session that we did. We have a do now at the beginning, which is usually like easy like recall questions about what they've written about. We give them like when we're looking at their books, we are taking down everything that they're not doing right and everything they are doing right, but we're not putting all of that on the whole class feedback sheet because we know that that's going to be really cognitively overloading and they're not going to be able to actually change their writing. So we're looking for like the highest leverage things and we're looking for patterns across lots of students' writing, as Josie explained in the talk. So we talk about the vocabulary that we want them to instruct, that we want to re-instruct. So for example, in my recent year 8 piece of writing on Romeo and Juliet, they were getting the word inadvertently and inevitably confused. And I instructed both of those and they were saying that tragedy was inadvertent and actually they should be saying that tragedy is inevitable. So I would just have those words on the slide and I'll re-instruct that because that's a vocabulary misconception. And then after that, there'd be a short activity that I've planned that's where they have to circle the correct word in a sentence, for example, so that they have to show me that they've understood based on that really deliberate and small piece of feedback.
Then we might talk about grammar. So we might like, for example, in my year 10s, they are constantly using apostrophes incorrectly for Macbeth's or for Dickens's. But they're also doing loads of things, other things wrong too. But I'm just going to think, actually, that's the highest leverage thing. If we can master that in this session, I can do some instruction on it. I'm going to park the fact that they are forgetting to use quotation marks for single word quotations. I'm going to do that next week and I'm going to include it in my instruction for the next lesson. But I'm just going to focus on apostrophes. So again, like really limiting the scope, being able to pick out the highest leverage thing and doing that work for students because like it's very noisy, not literally, but like writing is a noisy process. Like there's a lot of things you have to consider. So we might talk about giving like one particular instruction about grammar. Then we will move on and talk about a misconception. This will probably be a plot misconception. So it might be related to misunderstanding who Tybalt's related to, or it might be the chronology of A Christmas Carol, for example. They might be getting confused. So we've drawn that out from the patterns in the books. We're instructing this one misconception. We're parking the others and we're going to refer to them later or integrate it into our scripting in the future. And then finally, we move on to the targets that we're going to give for their actual writing. All of these things, we have to be really explicit to students that they relate to the writing that they did and that they should be using this instruction when they do their rewrite. We think that really good writers do lots of redrafts. We know really good writers do lots of redrafts. Kids hate doing redrafts though. So we really have to like support them, scaffold the redrafting and demand it of them because we know that when they write an email, or when they write some coursework, or when they write an essay, it won't be good the first time. Like it never is. So we really want to like embed that. We also want them to be able to, in an exam, scan through their work and self-prompt. So to be able to say, oh, I should put a because there, oh, I should put a noun and positive there. So that's when we get into the targets, which is the final part of the lesson where we'll give a really precise grammatical or art of the sentence target along with some vocab maybe that they should include. We might write a maximum of 3 of these and write a number in the student's book. So the only thing the student will write in a student's book is the number of the target that they need to do. We also, just from a practical note, we like highlight in the margin how many lines we want to write in their redraft. And that can be quite a good, like easy accountability measure for students.
And also practically, just because I know this is some people interested in this, we don't stipulate how teachers have to share this MAD time at our school at South Bank. It's MAD time, make a difference time. So we have 2 different options. We've shared both of them, but the sheet itself, if a teacher chose to like type onto the sheet and then the kids stick it in, it's like, as Josie explained, but just because I feel like this is what the other thing you wanted from your question, it's got shout outs, misconceptions, spelling, grammar, and targets, all as just like simple boxes on the sheet. Sorry, there's a child whistling on the side, just in case anyone doubted that we were in a school. That's the same structure that's on the PowerPoint. And teachers can choose how they want to do that. There's lots of different ways
you can. How often do you give that kind of feedback?
So we do it twice a half term, so that's like two times every 6 or 7 weeks. And we suggest a piece of work that the whole department do the marked piece on, but we're actually pretty flexible on this, not that many other things.
It's one tiny thing.
It's pretty amazing. People can actually choose. So they can mark anything, really. But yes, minimum of two times a half term.
I see. And then the
good thing about this process is like it models a thinking process you want teachers to do all the time. So like we would also expect that as they circulate the classroom, they might take that opportunity to do a quick grammar reteach because they've noticed one thing that's going wrong. So it's not always this like formalized take in the books kind of thing. As we said in our talk, like feedback is lots of things. And one of those things looks like circulating, pausing the class and just doing a quick reteach on inadvertently. Where that's necessary. But the good thing about having this kind of structural sheet means that as a teacher, I have a way of like organizing my thinking, even if I'm circulating the classroom. So it's, it can serve that purpose as well.
How do you check? So like it's because it's such an inviting idea, obviously, that it would expedite the market process, which is quite not onerous necessarily, but very time consuming for English teachers. Like over time, how do you check that the misconceptions have been reviewed and the correct approach has been internalized? Like in the long term, if you're doing this like twice a term or half term or something like that, there's obviously like a finite amount of time that you have to do this, and then they go on to the next teacher in year 8 or year 9 or year 10. What kind of strategies do you have in place to kind of check in the long term?
It's such a good question. I feel like we've been like talking to each other and to other people about this topic for a while, and this has really made us think, and I think probably we don't have the full answer to your question yet. I can tell you what we've got so far, but it's such a good question, isn't it? Like we're very like confidently saying that we're doing all of these things.
And we're like changing that.
Yeah, we're like
approach to writing.
Yeah, they know this word. I know that for sure. They know, you know, that in year 9, they know the word like fascination from the earlier bit of year 9. And like we're really like saying with our chest that kids know all this stuff. And like we know that the challenge to everything we've said so far is that they act like to check whether they actually know it. And we believe that like what we call circulate, notice and respond is like the best thing that teachers can do to check if things are actually embedded and if there's actually mastery, but there has to be flexibility in a scheme of work to be able to go back and re-instruct. So we recognize that that's the big thing that all of this rests on. I guess for us it's about how can the classroom teacher do it, and then what can you do in the department? So the classroom teacher should be, and this is something that would be they'd be held accountable for in line management, looking for patterns not just between students' books on one piece of work, but also across that whole half term. So if Josie instructed to her year 10s the apostrophe thing, she basically does need to remember, and like maybe she writes it down, and like maybe get people like we would have that conversation informally, but like the expectation is that Josie does have to retain that bit, and like if I know as her line manager that she spoke about apostrophes, I know that's a really small and easy example, but I'll just use it for now. Then I do, if I'm looking at, we ask teachers to bring student books to every line management meeting, so if I'm looking at her year 10 books like 3 months later, I need to know that she remembers that they made that mistake 3 months ago, and that like something's being done about it, and she can't just sit there and say it's weird because I did give them a mad time in January or whatever. That's an accountability measure there for classroom teachers, but I think that we can't just put the onus on classroom teachers to do that, and our classroom teachers don't make any curriculum, and that's a really lucky thing for them, and it means they can do lots of important thinking about the way through the text, like we've said, but we need to be really explicit about how this is the responsibility that does fall on them and that they need to take really seriously. So, and they do. So then on a department level for us, it's about how do those small minute patterns noticed in every book and every classroom and every half term inform our future planning? Like if everybody is noticing that children can't move between the extract and the whole text in their Christmas Carol essays, that's a really huge thing. And so what are we actually doing next year when we teach it? Or, I mean, we wouldn't wait till next year, actually. Like, Josie would make a PowerPoint and we would like put those interventions in after having collected the patterns from across the department. So I guess like as each individual teacher is collecting patterns, as department leads, we're also collecting those patterns and responding to them by trying to inform teacher practice. So that's one way. And then we also do co-planning for 45 minutes a week, where we talk about one unit for the whole half term. And we look at the lessons that we're going to teach on that unit and talk about the way through the unit and the vocab and everything. That would be a really good place to talk about some of the potential misconceptions from previous year of teaching, or like things to really deliberately instruct or watch out for. So that's as far as we've got. I forgot to put
them in. Yeah, I think you mentioned about how like what do we do, because these kids are going to be with us for 1 year and then they'll have a new teacher the next year. And I think that's where what Bryony said about co-planning is really important, but also even more important is taking the responsibility as teachers of knowing what they learned the year before. And because that's not by accident, and because it is planned quite explicitly, because it is codified, that's not so difficult to do. But it is hard, like when you're teaching William Blake and you think, I'm going to say that the nurse believes that children waste their youth. And actually, I could have said the nurse believes that the children squander their youth because they learned that in year seven. And if I don't do that, then basically I'm telling my year eights that what you did in year seven doesn't matter. And often as teachers, I think we meet in new classes if they've never learned anything before, even when we have a curriculum that's so sequenced and so codifies all the learning that they should have done, because as teachers, we feel we don't have the time or capacity to look back at what they've actually learned. And so when I was teaching Nurse a Song and I realized I taught the lesson, I said the nurse wasted, that believes that children wasted their childhood. And I really kicked myself because I thought, actually, what would be really powerful is if teachers, including myself, if all teachers, if we could be much better at really having moments where we look back at previous content, it's mapped, it's sequenced, it's codified, and we didn't treat the kids like they never learned, they never done English lessons before until we met them. And so bringing that word squandered from before.
And practically, like, we recognize that's really hard. I teach year eight now, and I was lucky enough to teach year seven last year, and I have retained that, so I don't need to do any work, because I taught some of those kids last year. I would have said squandered, but I also teach year nine this year and I didn't teach year eight last year, and I don't actually 100% know what they learned at the second half of year eight. And like, I'm the head of department and I really, really care about this. So we are thinking about, and like, I think it's important to make that as easy, like putting the responsibility on teachers, but also making it easy for them is always going to be a balance in everything in leadership. And I think like it has to be an expectation that we share that vocabulary, and that we make, like, yeah, we're trying to think about how to do that.
Yeah.
So basically, we don't really know for sure, but we have lots of ways.
We'll come back to you in a few years. Call the second
year of the curriculum. What I was going to say was that I think, yeah, it was more of a kind of a question coming from a devil's advocate perspective. But like, just to go back to what Josie said like a while ago, which is about like the importance of revision and things like that. I'm not sure which kind of motivational book thing that I read this in, but like, it's quite a well-known quote, that idea that like a very small change can often yield like the biggest results. And I think for years, or for decades, we've kind of had that the wrong way around, where we've been like marking the books for hours, hoping for like an equally kind of sized reaction or change in the students' learning. And I think just kind of getting the students to understand that if they show a little bit of what's the word, kind of confidence or resilience, and understand that like it that they can make their work so much better just through the process of revision and stuff like that, then when they learn things, I think these things do become more sticky. They stop being like passive receivers of information and start kind of putting it into a wider schema and things like that. So yeah, for what it's worth, it was a devil's advocate question.
No, I love that. But it is the right question. Like, yeah, the devil's right. It's a good question. I also think what you're saying, and the references that you've made to like this as part of a wider shift in English teaching, I do think that it's the questions that we're starting to ask and the things we're starting to say, and I mean, the larger subject community on like We Are in Beta or Twitter, or just like, and all the people who are in neither of those places who are having the exact same thoughts. We are basically trying to shift. There used to be a really clear sense of what it means to be a good teacher. And like that changes over time. And of course that's always happened. Like that's what movement of time is like. But I think it's a bit tough for people. And I've certainly found it tough. Like when I trained, like the good teachers, if you were a good teacher, people would, if someone said, is that person a good teacher who you worked with? One of the things that you would cite, you'd be like, oh yeah. They take a suitcase of books home every Friday. Like, you know, they've always got 17 red pens on them when they're walking around the classroom and they're writing in every single student's books. Like their classroom, they've got a special pen when it's verbal feedback. They've got a special stamp. They've got like, there were all of these things that like we were like really told by like explicitly or implicitly.
Yeah.
I mean, I was told them explicitly when I was training, and I was only training in 2015. We were like, it's not that long ago. That's what it meant to be a good teacher. And like, it's understand that it's a big thing to say. And when we found one saying to teachers who train even more recently than us, like
just write
that even, and I, as I said, like, even if I, yeah, just write a number. And like it, the fact that we're, the reason we're doing this is not just for saving teacher workload. And I sort of miscommunicated it the first time I was talking to the department, and I went big on like whole class feedback. It's about saving your time. And like some teachers were like, but I'm a good teacher. I'm the teacher who takes books home on the weekend.
I want to spend the time
because I'm a good teacher. I'm the teacher who has the kids in my classroom, and like, you know, the good teacher of old who has like, who does one-on-one interventions with every kid, you know, like all of those things. So that's actually not the right way to pose it. It's actually, even if I had an infinite number of hours in my week and all the suitcases and all the pens and no life, which I don't have to imagine. And then I still wouldn't choose to write a paragraph in every student's book. Yeah. And I think that was Josie who said that to me about like the way to frame that to teachers. And I've really always gone, whole class feedback saves your time. But actually it's like, we're trying to change the answer to what does it mean to be a good teacher on loads of levels. And it's putting the onus on the children, but it's also really limiting what you're asking them to do. So we're putting a number in their book. And that's like, there's a, you know, all the stuff we've said, basically, it just seems like very, very different to 5-6 years ago.
Yeah. And like, it's still really hard work, you know?
Yeah.
It's still a lot of, I think the question we have to ask is like, as teachers, where do we want, we have a finite amount of time. Like, where do we want to spend it? Where do we want to spend the energy and like limited resources that we have in our brain?
Mm.
And where is it best spent in a way that is impactful for students, but also impactful for students to come and impactful for our practice, not just impactful for one student in the moment before they throw their book away or move on to next year. And so that's why, like, even though you're writing a number in a book, you're actually like thinking much harder.
There's a whole architecture behind that number that maybe there wasn't if you're writing prose and beautiful purple pens.
I love all the constant references to the purple pen. In terms of like this, like you were saying, Bridie, this kind of like this dynamic shift, or this shift in dynamic, I should say. You also talked about and the We Are Beta, the Comcast thing that you did. Like, you talked a little bit about models, exemplars, live writing, and stuff like this. Which again, I think, when I was training, or when I was a kind of beginning teacher and stuff like that, I thought the idea of models and live exemplars, like this was not a revolutionary idea, but it was something that was being pushed as, you know, a very effective way to get students to understand what excellent looks like. And I think you guys had like a really interesting kind of comment to make about this in terms of why, you know, models, exemplars and live writing are good, but they're not entirely effective in terms of guiding students' understanding of a task. Why is that?
So I think the main thing to say is like, we're not saying don't ever show a model, don't ever make it. We're saying like a lot of that work should happen invisibly to the student. So it should happen in our head. So like, of course, we should always know what the final task of every lesson should look and sound like. We should know what that looks and sound like based on the knowledge we've taught students, it should include the elements of sentence instruction, vocabulary, and content that we've taught students. And we should definitely go through the process of writing out every lesson 100%. What we are saying, though, is that that isn't always the thing that students need to see, because seeing the whole can sometimes really alienate students. It also is asking a lot of them to extrapolate patterns from a piece of writing, a paragraph, or an essay. And that extrapolation of patterns isn't the best use of their the cognitive resources they have. So if you imagine the experience of a student in your classroom who meets a model paragraph, even if contained within that paragraph is all the elements that they have explicitly been taught, it's still a big piece of writing and a big piece of cognitive work to do for them to read it and then replicate it. And ultimately, that's what we're asking students to do when we show them a model essay or a model paragraph. We're asking them to read it and then replicate it. And we would never do that in any other part of teaching. We wouldn't just say hey, here's a poem, write a poem.
Or here's a dance performance.
Now
watch
it
and do it.
Yeah. Or yeah, exactly. Or here's an experiment, now do the experiment. We would always scaffold the route to this excellence. And so there's always going to be a time and a place where we would show students the model. We might do it once every half term. We might do it every couple of weeks. We might write a live model in inverted commas with students. All of those things do have a place. But I think often we see it as the answer when actually it isn't. It just poses more questions for students than it does answers. We do think that the cognitive work for teachers should be spent doing that, should be spent really thinking, what do I want them to write? And therefore, what questions am I going to ask? What do now am I going to have? What's the pause point? What's the multiple choice quiz? How am I going to get them there? But it's the getting them there that we lose out if we skip, if we only show them the final product. So asking cold questions while we're live modeling is a great thing to do for sure. We like to as much as possible, work on the micro level before we get to the macro level. So I think looking at sentence level construction and redrafting and modeling the process of redrafting. So if you go into lots of our classrooms, you'll see a sentence construction on the board. You'll see lots of pen. You'll see additions and modeling that thinking process. All of that is really important. It's important to codify the process that excellent writers go through. It's just that sometimes we think we've done that when we write a model answer and show it to kids, and we haven't done it. There's loads of steps that have to exist in between. Showing kids an essay isn't the same as showing them how to write an essay.
Or even the the live writing thing, like you said, it is such a good analogy to use in terms of a dance recital or football or rugby or something like that. You would never dream of walking a student or an emerging teacher through a process which is 100 decisions. How many decisions do you need to make when you write an essay? It's hundreds, if not maybe even thousands. So they might understand it in the moment, but once they leave the class, it's another matter entirely. Yeah. Anyway, the only thing that remains for me to say is thank you very much for giving up part of your Friday afternoon, Friday evening to speak to me today. It was really, really good to watch you guys on the Comcast thing, first of all, and I'll try and link to that We Are Beta stuff in the podcast notes, and it's really worth watching for anyone who hasn't watched it already. But thank you for all your output on Twitter and just general fantastic approach to the subject and your learners and all that kind of thing. So thank you very much, Josie and Bridie.
Thank you. It's been really enjoyable.